excited to come. You won't understand a word anyone is saying, but I think just sitting there would be an enjoyable experience for you. I'll tell them to get you a seat right up in front so you can see what's going on in there. And then he was gone.
This is so weird, one of the aides said. I can't believe he invited you, of all people, to the advanced tantric. You have to study for 50 years to get in there. I made my way to the outdoor class, and they sat me down right in the front. The class was filled with these crazy-ass old monks wearing big Roman-looking headgear. They were all meditating and making noises. The Dalai Lama was sitting on an elevated platform, and an aide beside him was doing most of the talking and reading. They started passing around a silver goblet filled with rancid yak milk. All of the elder monks took a good hearty sip of the brew, so I thought, yeah, baby, give me some of that rancid yak milk. The monk passed me the goblet, and I took a sip, but I was not prepared. I thought I could handle some weird-tasting shit, but this was not it. So that was why it took 50 years to be prepared for the course. I left at the first break, thoroughly impressed by the perseverance of the monks. Before leaving for New Zealand and India, I had suggested to Louis that he and Sherry move in with me, because Sherry was expecting a child. I thought it would be nice to invite the energy and warmth and life of a family into my relatively unlived-in house. So I came home to them and baby Cash living under my roof. Cash was an amazing kid, and we had a nice family environment, making popcorn and watching movies together. But it wasn't long before I started running again. When I started getting high, my friends didn't understand it. They all thought, oh, now he's met the Dalai Lama, he'll never get loaded again. That had nothing to do with drugs. I didn't have to go all the way to India for spiritual enlightenment. The blue-collar spirituality of everyday life was right in front of me. It was in every nook and cranny if I wanted to seek it, but I had chosen to ignore it. I started doing the downtown motel circuit, staying out for 6 or 7 day runs. The only inconvenience was now I had a whole family at home, waiting nervously for me to come back. On one of those trips, I sneaked home at 5 in the morning, trying not to wake Cash up. I wanted to slip into my bedroom and go to sleep for a couple of days, and deal with the consequences of worried people as far into the future as possible, when I saw that Sherry had set up a little shrine for me. She had taken one of the pictures of the Dalai Lama and me and framed it in a sweet little tacky frame and set up a bowl of popcorn next to it. That almost broke my heart. Another time, I sneaked in late at night and opened the door to my room. A little guy sat up in the bed and said, "Oh, God, please! Oh, oh!" It was Lewis's dad, sleeping in my bed in my absence. I had come back because I needed some more cash to continue my run. As I got some money and started to leave, Sherry was beside herself. "That's it! Enough, motherfucker! You're going to go into rehab! This is crazy!" she said. I agreed to get on my motorcycle and go into Impact, an end-of-the-line rehab in Pasadena. The image of Pasadena is a safe, calm, residential paradise where the little old lady of Beach Boys fame comes from, but North Pasadena, where Impact was located, was a straight hardcore projects ghetto. Impact was known as the last house on the block. After you'd been to every rehab and every jail, that was where you ended up. It was the ultimate no-nonsense, get-sober-or-die place. There I was at 34, sharing a room with 3 other guys. I was determined to make it through the entire 28-day stay this time and begin to work through my demons. The problem was, despite all the work I did there, I never wanted to be sober the whole time I was there. I was inching my way forward and white-knuckling not getting high, but my desire to get loaded was still very much a part of my consciousness. Every day I'd spend at least a couple of hours thinking about going out and getting some money and getting high and doing it all over again. It was worse when I went to outside meetings. Since Impact was run on a merit system, the more merits you got, the more perks you'd accumulate. One of the perks was going to meetings outside the facility. Whenever we'd pile into those short buses and drive to a meeting, I'd stare out the window at the seediest bars in the seediest neighborhoods and fantasize about going in there and drinking with other barflies. Anything to get me out and rolling again. Once I got settled in, the daily routine wasn't so bad. You'd wake up, do your prayer and meditation, make your bed, and shower. Everyone in my bungalow was considerate and cleaned up so we wouldn't get negative write-ups and extra homework. My roommates fascinated me. I felt horrible for the white trash kid from Florida. I could see that he was struggling and that his chances for recovery weren't so good, especially with a wife who shared the same obsession. A lot of the other people there were facing their third strike and looking at serious jail time if they didn't straighten out. After tidying up your room, you'd go down to the cafeteria, which was a fun place to hang out. The food was all fat, starch, and sugar, the worst imaginable, but it was intended to put some weight back on your frame. Everyone piled on the food. There was an enormous selection of desserts at every meal, including breakfast. I wasn't eating meat in there, but I was hitting the sweets big time. My typical day at Impact was different from most others. For some reason, they didn't treat me like a normal person. Everyone got work assignments like mowing the lawn and mopping the floor, but I was assigned to an advanced relapse prevention class, which was intense and time-consuming. During the course of this class, we all got a day or two to draw a big calendar of the last 8 years of our lives on an enormous chalkboard. Then we entered the major events and dates when our relapses occurred and what preceded and followed them. I was in this class with 20 other chronic relapsers, and they started pointing out the obvious, that each time I entered a relationship with a woman, it precipitated a relapse. I realized I had an issue, that there was something in the dynamic of hurting somebody's feelings that always sent me out the door. That really manifested after I broke up with Jamie and started going out with a number of different girls for short amounts of time. It was go out with a girl for a month, break up, relapse. I stayed at Impact my prescribed length of time and did all the work in the relapse class, including filling out pages and pages of questionnaires, which was a psychologically productive thing to do. When you start putting pen to paper, you see a side of your personal truth that doesn't otherwise reveal itself in conversation or thought. I also liked these psychological exercises because there was a young hot shrink who had recently come to Impact. I spent a lot of time in her office. We'd break out the Rorschach tests and go out and sit in the shade of this compound, and I'd look at the ink blots and make some sexual innuendos, and we'd both flirt. There was no point in doing serious psychotherapy, since I was getting out in less than 4 weeks, so it was just nice to spend some time together. I left Impact and got back on board with my recovery. I was feeling pretty optimistic and healthy and happy about my life and the band. Lindy had booked a summer tour for us, so my intention was to start getting in shape for the road. One Sunday morning that spring, I was on my motorcycle going to my favorite meeting, which was in a rec room in a park at 3rd and Gardner. I was moving at a good clip, as I was prone to do, but I'd never had any real mishaps on my bike. I'd studied the road conditions and exercised caution at intersections and assumed that cars would pull out at inopportune moments from driveways or parking spots. I was always alert and prepared to deal with those scenarios. All this was going through my mind as I flew down Gardner, which was a narrow side street with cars parked on both sides. In a split hair of a moment, this car pulled out of a parking spot and started to make a U-turn, effectively cutting off the entire street. Normally, you'd have a backdoor exit, even if it meant cutting onto the sidewalk, but now there was no way out. This idiot had blocked the whole street and there was no driveways accessible. I used both my brakes, but the car was too close. There was an incredibly fast and violent collision, so strong that the bike pierced the vehicle. I flew off the bike and jackknifed right into the point where the driver's door met the engine compartment. Amazingly enough, I hit the car and proceeded to somersault forward, landing square on my feet on the other side of the car. I kept my balance and started running, so I assumed that by some miracle, I was okay. Except when I looked down at my arm, it wasn't an arm anymore. My hand had been shoved up into my forearm, so now I had a double-decker, big, bulbous club of a forearm and no hand. Oh my God, I thought. This is really, really wrong-looking. Without stopping to consider how badly I was injured, I ran into the closest house without knocking. I took a few steps into the living room, thinking I'd grab the phone and call an ambulance, but then the initial shock wore off, and the worst pain of my life jolted my body. There was no time to call for help, so I turned around and ran back outside and flagged down a convertible that happened to be occupied by two women I knew who were on their way to the same meeting as I had been. I ignored the driver of the car I had hit, who wanted to trade insurance information, and jumped into the back seat. We made a beeline for Cedar Sinai. Later, I would learn that the hand has more nerve cells than any other part of the body, which explained the intense pain. But at that point, it just felt like my hand had been immersed in a hot bottle of lava. I was convinced I'd never have a hand again. Within 5 minutes, I was at the hospital, being wheeled into emergency surgery. Just my luck, an amazing hand specialist, Dr. Culber, was on duty. But first they had to prep me for surgery, which entailed giving me a healthy dose of morphine. I felt nothing. I turned to the nurse and said, "Unfortunately, over a lifetime of misbehavior, I've attained a rather enormous resistance to the opiate family of drugs. You're probably going to have to go ahead and double that dose right away." Another shot. Nothing. It wasn't even putting a dent in the pain. This process went on and on. They wound up giving me 7 doses of morphine before I got some relief. The pain was gone, and the nurses started looking mighty attractive. And the next thing I knew, I had my hand up the nurse's skirt and was flirting with a female doctor. I was a fucking patient from hell who had gotten the most morphine in Cedars-Sinai history. It took Dr. Culber 5 hours to reconstruct my hand from that pulverized mass of bone and matter. After a few days in the hospital, they fixed me up with a specialty cast that went all the way up to my shoulder. It wasn't until I got home that I recognized how dependent we are on our hands. Even something as mundane as wiping your ass became a big issue. I had to train my left hand to do things it had never done before. I couldn't write, I couldn't open a door or a window. Getting dressed and tying my shoes were nearly impossible. For some reason, all this didn't really bring me down. I hated not being able to sleep comfortably, and I didn't enjoy the excruciating pain, but I kept the outlook that I would find a way to use my hand again. And so began many, many months of hand therapy. I was lucky enough to find Dr. Doors, a Burbank physician whose practice revolved around rehabbing hands. He had a unique way of doing therapy. You were placed in a room with 20 other people who had severe hand injuries, all helping one another. When you see people with much worse injuries than your own, you thank God and decide you can deal with it. It took me 9 months, but I got back most of the strength in that injured hand. We had to cancel dates in Alaska and Hawaii because of my accident, but then Lindy called and asked if I could play the festival at Mount Fuji at the end of July. We were headlining and making a lot of money for that one show, and we hadn't worked that entire year. By that time, my cast was down to my elbow, so I figured if I just kept my arm in my sling, playing was doable. There was only one catch. As we checked into our hotel, we found out there was a super typhoon coming directly at us from the south. It was estimated to hit our area just when we were going to be on stage. The morning of our show, the rains began, but there were 80,000 Japanese out on this mountainside, so not playing wasn't an option. The opening acts went on, and all the time we were keeping an eye on the weather reports, which all said that the big one was getting closer and closer. Finally, it was time to play. We looked out at the audience, and the kids were soaking wet and frozen to the bone. People were being taken away suffering from hypothermia, but no one was leaving voluntarily. So we hit the stage, and there was a little bit of a cover, though not enough to keep the windy rain from flying around. The energy from this storm was building everybody up, so we nailed the set. Chad O was banging out the beat, and Dave was really going for it. It was the first time in a while that I'd been sober for a few months straight, so I was feeling great. The stronger we played, the stronger the wind got. At one point, I remember being up at the front of the stage on the mic, and the wind was so robust that I leaned into it, and it held me up. Then the winds got even heavier, and shit started to blow off the stage. The equipment was still working, so we kept playing until the lighting rig blew away. We were about 8 songs into the show, and we'd fulfilled our contractual and moral obligations by then. So we ran for our lives. August 1997 was pretty uneventful. I was back in L.A., still living with my little extended family. But when September rolled around, I got the old familiar urgings, and decided it was time to get a bunch of drugs and do them for just one day. There was no downside, because Jane's Addiction were doing a comeback tour that fall, and Flea had decided to fill in as the bass player, which meant Flea and Dave had their own separate thing for a few months, and I had plenty of time on my hands. Out of deference to little baby Cash, I decided to get high in my car and not bring that energy into the house. So I got my stuff and started driving back toward Hollywood, but I was too impatient. So I pulled over to a side street and fired up my pipe. After a few hits, I got paranoid and decided to check into a hotel to continue my bacchanal. I found a nice fancy hotel down on Pico and Beverly and thought that would do for a night. I went up to the counter and the desk person lit up.
"Mr. Kiedis, it's an honor to have you at our hotel," he said.
One night turned into two nights, which turned into three nights. At one point, I had to drive downtown to replenish my supplies. I slept for a day and woke up and ordered plates and plates of quarter-pound burgers. Then the whole cycle began again. Days went by, getting high, getting high, getting high. Each day I'd have to call the front desk and tell them my plans had changed and I was staying for yet another day. So it was drugs, 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 sleep, sleep, sleep. Wake up emaciated, beat down, sad, depressed, demoralized, hurt, lonely, destroyed. Order room service and watch a little TV. This went on for a few weeks. I woke up one night around 11 and discovered that I had copped a heroin habit. I ate some food and looked at myself in the mirror and said, "Jesus Christ, you're a wreck, brother. You better go hide under a mountain of cocaine and heroin right away." I checked my pockets. I had some feeble amount of change, but I wasn't worried because I knew I had about $5,000 in a suit pocket at my house. That would cover me for another week. In fact, my whole closet was filled with the accoutrements of serious damage doing. I had jackets that had drugs, jackets that had pipes, jackets that had syringes, jackets that had money, jackets that had Polaroid sex photos, the whole gamut. I would have to scoot home, run up to my closet, grab the cash, and deal with Sherry and Louie. I was a possessed madman, so I planned to tell them to back off, mind their own business, and I'd get better when I got better. If I didn't, that was the price I had to pay. I drove up to my house, pressed the garage door opener, pulled in, and got a huge shock. The garage was empty. My bikes were gone. My surfboard was gone. The crazy mirror on the wall, the shelving unit, all gone. All the concrete was polished and impeccably clean. My heart started pounding as I tried to come up with an explanation. Maybe they wanted to have the place painted, so they took everything out. Or maybe there was a spill of some kind, but it didn't look like somebody had cleaned up. Everything was gone. I climbed up the stairs, slammed my key into the door, and prepared to do battle with Louie and Sherry. I opened the door and walked right into the Twilight Zone. Except it was real. Nothing was in the house. No furniture, no paintings, no posters, no silverware, no pots and pans, no glasses, no plates, no cups, no trinkets, no doodads, no bric-a-brac, no television, no chandelier, no toilet paper, no toothbrush. It was like a vacuum from God had come down and sucked out my house. I was thinking that if the bottom floor looked like this, what if I went to the next floor and there were no clothes in my closet and my jacket with the $5,000 was gone? I ran up the stairs to my bedroom. Empty. No bed, no curtains, no desk, no pillows, no nothing. Ran into the closet just in case. Nothing. There was no one, nothing in the house. I can't even stress the nothing enough. There wasn't a thimble. What I didn't remember was that I'd had a casual conversation a few weeks earlier with a realtor and told him I was thinking of selling. I didn't tell him that I'd done so much heroin in the house that the couch was high. The realtor told me that it would probably take about a year to get my price, but he'd found a motivated buyer. So the motherfucker sold my house in 1 week, and my possessions were packed up and put into storage. I was in a panic. It was midnight. I had one bad Jones and no money. My entire life depended on getting money. So I drove back to my hotel and remembered that somebody in our crew would routinely get money in Europe by asking the front desk to advance him cash and charge his room account. Back at the hotel, there was a new girl on the all-night desk. I asked her for $500.
"Oh, I've only been working here 2 days. I'm not familiar with that procedure," she said. "Can you wait till tomorrow when the manager gets in?"
"No, I can't," I said. "As a matter of fact, blah, 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 lie, 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 such and such and such. And I do it all the time." I put the Jedi mind whammy on her and got the money and was out the door, straight down Olympic to my one-stop pool hall. My stay at the hotel continued. I went to an American Express office and got more money, which meant more drugs. By then I was a walking skeleton with muddy, dead, no-one's-at-home eyes. I was lying in bed, watching the local news, when I saw a report about the Jane's Addiction reunion tour. It made me feel horrible that my friends were out playing music and I was alone in a hotel room, wasting away. But I couldn't stop. I changed hotels and kept the run going until the day of my 35th birthday, when I checked into a rehab in Ventura called Steps. They took one look at my arms and figured I'd been shooting heroin for a few years straight.
"Don't you worry about a thing. You're going on a 4-day mega detox. We'll wake you up for meals, but other than that, you're going to be out. By the time we see you in a week, you'll be detoxed, with no physical dependency on anything." I was like, great, where do I sign?
I started getting the biggest combination of detox medication I'd ever been on. Clonidine patches, chloral hydrate, Valiums, muscle relaxers. I was like rubber noodles the whole time, in bed with no arm or leg control, just goofazoid out. After 3 days of sleeping and eating, I woke up and thought, I gotta go get high. I was still wasted on the detox medications, and I was a good 100-odd miles from downtown. My main problem was that I couldn't walk. They couldn't legally keep me there, but they would never give me my car keys. I stood up and could barely steady myself in the room, but I was able to scheme and plot. All right, the office with the guy in it is down the hall, I thought. If I hold on to the wall the entire way to the office and get in there and lean up against a door jamb, maybe they'll think I'm okay. I walked down that hallway holding on to the wall, went into the office, puffed myself up, thanked them for everything, and demanded my keys. After a minor argument, they conceded. But then I had to wait until no one was watching me so I could incorporate the wall into my normal walking rhythm. It all worked out. I stopped at a bank and got as much cash as I could, and I made record time downtown. I scored my drugs, checked into a motel, and stayed up all night trying to get as much heroin into my system as I could. I hatched a new brilliant plan. I would go to Big Sur, which was a lot farther away from L.A. than Ventura, find a hotel, and wean myself off heroin. I flew up and checked into the Ventura Inn. That first night, I plowed through all of the heroin that I'd brought to gradually wean myself of, just gobbled it down like a pig. And so began the harrowing ordeal of kicking heroin once again. Luckily, I could eat when there were no drugs, but I started going through a horrible sleepless period of physical and emotional pain. I was experiencing a proper heroin withdrawal, the likes of which I hadn't for quite a long time. I'd make fires in the fireplace and get too hot, so I'd open the window and freeze to death. I couldn't have a blanket over my legs because it felt like pins and needles. Even the pillow hurt my neck. After the first day, the hotel refused to send up room service, so I was forced to go down to the restaurant or walk a mile down a hill to a market. All that walking and fresh air started to bring me back to life. While I was there, I called up my boyhood pal Joseph Walters, who was living in Palo Alto and going through a catastrophe with his crazy-ass fiance. He drove down and we commiserated for a few days. Somehow, I found out that Jane's addiction was playing San Francisco, so Joe drove me up there and then went back home. Guy O was in town for the shows, so we went together. I was excited because I was starting to feel human again. Plus, I was going to see my brothers. I went backstage and saw Flea and was all happy to see him, but he didn't seem like himself. He was dressing differently and wearing eye makeup, and changing his Flea-ness to become Jane's addiction-ness, which I didn't understand. I thought he'd be Flea in this other band, not a whole new persona. He seemed strangely distant. I don't know if he was angry with me for being a fuck-up or if he was on his own weird trip, but I accepted that he was in that mode. Then Dave walked in the room. I was always happy to see him. He greeted me, told me it was great to see me, and that he'd be right back to talk. But he was high and messing around with some girl, and they went off to do more drugs and never came back. It was fun to watch the show, even though it did seem weird to see Flea in that band. That night I walked home with Guy O, feeling detached from both Flea and Dave, which was ironic since I had just detached from them for months on end. I accepted that this was what happens when you don't talk to anybody. You come back and it's a new ballgame. I was hoping it would be a new ballgame for me. The fact that my circumstances had changed drastically, but my behavior hadn't, was beginning to wear on me. I remember one poignant moment when I still had the house in the hills. I was driving down Beechwood at night and getting high in my car. I came to a stop sign, and this car full of 20-year-old boys pulled up next to me. They looked at me and said, "Hey, Anthony!" I was so torn up, the last thing I wanted to hear was, "Hey, Anthony," from some fans. I was trying to ignore them, but I sneaked a glance at their car.
One of them stared at me and said, "Hey, it's not him." And they drove off. That couldn't be him, because Anthony didn't look like a fucking ghost. It got worse. Another time on the motel tour, I pulled up to my downtown corner, and some desperado got in the car and told me he knew where to score some dope. He was doing this so he could get a taste for leading me to the prize, but I didn't care, so we took off. We ended up pulling into the parking lot of one of those cheap hooker motels on Sunset. He went off to find the dealer, and I was waiting in my truck when this family got out of their car and headed for their room. They must have been a little down on their luck because they were staying here. I looked over at their car and saw a Chili Peppers bumper sticker on it. Then I looked at the kids, and they both had on Chili Peppers t-shirts. I felt horribly ashamed and embarrassed. I slouched in my seat and pulled the visor down. Here was a family of fans, proud to fly their red-hot colors, and I was at the same motel, but trying to score drugs from some insidious dope dealer. Oof. I was really trying to stay sober, so I moved into Gaio's house at the end of 1997. That Christmas, I went home, and Blackie introduced me to a beautiful, brilliant local girl. We spent a nice few weeks together, but by the time I had to leave Grand Rapids, I knew the interlude would end. Sure enough, true to my impact relapse charts, a few weeks later, and 2 weeks before we were scheduled to leave for Hawaii to begin writing a new album, I went on another guns-blazing, full-speed-ahead run. I came up with yet another ridiculous plan. I decided to use drugs like a maniac for days on end and then go to Hawaii a week before the band, so that by the time we started working, I'd have a week of rest and recuperation under my belt. I dragged myself to the airport and flew solo to Hawaii. I checked into a luxury high-rise hotel in Waikiki, holding the last smidgen of dope that I had, telling myself, "Okay, I'm going to finish this little amount of stuff and then call it quits, and whammo, I'll get better right here in Hawaii." But when the drugs were ingested, I was like, "Oh, not quite ready to come down and face reality." I went to some strip bars to find dealers. When you're wrapped up in that kind of drug intake, you lose all sense of what's reasonable and what's not. Later that night, while I was injecting my drugs, I intentionally broke the needle off my only syringe because I thought if I put any more drugs in my body, I would explode. 10 minutes later, when I was craving more coke, that seemed like an awful idea. In my delusional toxic state, I tried to reaffix the needle. By now it was bent and it wasn't suctioning right, but a man needs his drugs in his veins, so I pushed the needle into a vein and hoped for the best. Well, I got the worst. The needle came off the syringe and lodged in the vein. I grabbed it and held it, paranoid that the needle would travel through my veins and pierce a valve in my heart. I was high and blood was leaking out of my arm, and now I had to grab the needle through my skin and pull it out from the inside, lest it get released into my bloodstream. I managed to get it out, but my next dilemma was that I had no heroin to come down from this coke with. I ended up drinking the entire contents of my minibar. The whiskey, the vodka, the scotch, the wine, one after another. I downed those little bottles and finally passed out. Always, you wake up to an unpleasant memory and an unpleasant body, and your spirit is reduced to a pile of dirty ashes residing somewhere inside of your ass. You've got to face the music, which is a beautiful island outside, but you can't even bear to look out the window. I kept those curtains drawn and stayed in that bed and ordered room service and hibernated, knowing that each day that clicked off the calendar was bringing me one day closer to when I had to get on a little plane and fly over to Kauai and see my friends, my bandmates, my compadres. The day of reckoning arrived. I went right down to the wire and got up an hour and a half before the plane was scheduled to depart and showered and shaved. I went out into the world for the first time in a week, and it was all too bright and vivid. But I got on that plane. I got to our rented house, and everyone was there, but our spirits were dampened. Both Dave and I had gone off the deep end for the last few weeks. We were both dry, at least for the moment, so we spent most of our time running and eating tons of good food, but unfortunately playing very little. I wasn't doing that well emotionally. I was dry, but my heart was broken, and I wasn't feeling like myself. Then we got the call that our old friend Bill Stobaugh, the hallucinogenius, the man who was my mentor at the graphics houses and who had let me live with him, had died while undergoing a heart operation. Flea flew back for the funeral, but I begged off.
When we got back from our unproductive stay in Hawaii, we got another dose of bad news. Our manager, Lindy, decided to quit. His wife had recently died, but he'd met a new lady, and she convinced him that it was time for him to walk away from that dose of anarchy and retire to Ojai. We looked like we were going backward on the conveyor belt, and I don't think she saw much of a future in us. Nor did he. Nor did anybody, really, including the people in the band. Back in L.A., Dave started working on a solo record with Chad and went right back to getting loaded. I had stayed sober since Hawaii. When I went to a party at Dave's girlfriend's house and Dave picked up a beer, I was surprised. He was so nonchalant about it. He and I were both in the same place, where one is too many and 1,000 is never enough. We couldn't use drugs moderately, and that would be proved to him in a short period of time. We went back to rehearsing. We had downgraded into an abominable little studio in Hollywood, right near Transvestite Alley. Dave was getting high and I wasn't, so that was adding more tension to an already tense situation. Dave would come into rehearsals wearing oversized sunglasses and over-the-top large floppy Renaissance hats, which we called coke hats, because you had to be on cocaine to even think of wearing a hat like that. Dave was coming in late, and it was impossible to communicate with him. The minute he was wearing that coke hat, he had his own agenda, and that was to get high. We tried to play, but we weren't going anywhere. Flea's face was sunken with disillusionment, and Chad was like, "This guy's off on his trip. What can you say?" I felt like we had to talk to Dave and get him some help. He used to come and pick me up at hotels to go into rehabs. It was my turn to talk to him about getting well so we could carry on. We had a little talk. Dave was sitting on an amplifier, and the band discussion escalated into an argument between the two of us, which was bizarre because all we were saying was, "Hey, you're using drugs while we're rehearsing and that's not working. How about if we talk about you getting sober again?" He didn't want to hear it. He had a real fuck you attitude about the whole thing. When he came at me with the fuck you attitude, I was like, "Well, fuck me, fuck you." Those weren't the exact words, but that was the energy that started to go around. Chad and Flea backed off, and Dave got up to get in my face. But as he tried to stand up, he went backward and fell behind the amp that he was sitting on. It was comical, but it was also sad. With the band once again stagnant, I decided to take a trip to Thailand. I had been diagnosed with hepatitis C a few years earlier, and even though I wasn't symptomatic, it was a disease that could reappear if I wasn't vigilant. I brought along my liver-cleansing herbs and swam a lot, prayed, and meditated on the idea of my body getting healthy. It worked. 3 weeks later, my hepatitis viral count came back undetectable. By now, it was April. Flea and I decided that it just wasn't working out. We had to fire Dave. Flea talked to him initially, but Dave was really upset, so I did the follow-up. It went horribly, because he was totally loaded, and even though he knew there was no way this band could work, the verbalization of the reality pissed him off to no end. "Fuck you guys. How can you do this to me, you motherfuckers?" "Dude, there's no band here," I said. "When was the last time you showed up? You're making a solo record. You're off getting loaded. You're not really into this anyway." Of course, Chad was staying totally Switzerland because he was in the middle of making that record with Dave. Meanwhile, Flea was going through his own health hell, fighting Epstein-Barr, as well as girlfriend hell and band hell. He was like a general doing battle on too many fronts. He was really down. And on top of all this, he was trying to do a solo album. It came as no surprise when Flea decided he wanted out. "I don't think I can do this anymore," he told me. I'd known this was coming. It was so obvious. Nothing was happening with the band. "I know," I said. "I figured that's what you were going to say. I totally understand." Then Flea dropped the bombshell. "The only way I could imagine carrying on is if we got John back in the band." That threw me for a loop. "Why would John ever want to come back and play with us again?" I asked Flea. "He doesn't care for me and didn't really care for the experience."
"I have a funny feeling he might be standing on the verge of making a comeback. A personal resurgence into the land of the living," Flea told me. That would be a wonderful miracle, I thought. And the second miracle would be if he'd ever think of playing with us again. You've got to be crazy,
John is not going to want to play in this band. It doesn't sound remotely possible, but if it is, I'm open to it, I told Flea. John and I hadn't had much contact since he left the band, except for the odd and unplanned moments that we'd run into each other. Even then, you'd have thought there would be a lot more anger and resentment and dislike, bordering on hatred, but every time I saw him, there was no display of that. The first time I saw him was a few years after he left the band. I had heard all these horror stories about John's descent into a drug hell, and I knew that Johnny Depp and Gibby Haynes, the lead singer of the Butthole Surfers, had even made a film documenting the squalid conditions that John was living in. If you saw that film, you knew that this was the home of a person who had absolutely no interest in life other than shooting drugs and painting. I also heard about the interviews that John was giving journalists extolling heroin use. He'd even shoot up during interviews. I wasn't interested in reading that stuff or looking at the film. I didn't listen to his solo records at the time. I couldn't celebrate his lifestyle because it seemed like he was killing himself. There were a lot of people who were glorifying that and wanting to participate and wanting to get free drugs. Granted, his art, the songs he was writing, were great, but it didn't feel right for me to condone this eccentric person's demise. This guy used to be my best friend, and now his teeth were falling out. So I didn't look at it like other people might. Oh, he's a genius, it's okay. I didn't care if he was a genius or a fucking idiot. He was rotting away, and it wasn't fun to watch. I knew he'd been painting for years, inspired by Basquiat and Da Vinci. So when I heard that he was going to have a show at the Zero Gallery on Melrose, I decided to pop in the day before the show opened and have a peek at the paintings. I dropped by, and lo and behold, John was there hanging the show himself. We were both a little startled. He was high on coke, and his hair was shorn, and he had big black circles under his eyes and was smoking Gauloises. He was shockingly thin, a skeleton in a vest, this little bone man. But he had a lot of vigor because he had a lot of energy and chemicals in him, so it wasn't like he was passing out or looking weak. Instead of being, "Fuck you, I hate you, you suck," we were happy to see each other. His paintings were disturbing but beautiful. It was weird because I think we wanted to dislike each other more than we were able to. The next time I saw him, he had deteriorated quite a bit. Everyone was worried about his arms, which were all abscessed because he never did learn how to properly administer an injection. He would just go for the stab-and-poke mode and hope for the best. He wound up checking into Exodus, my old haunt, in December 1995, more for his physical health than his mental health. The doctors there were seriously concerned that he was going to get gangrene and have to lose a limb unless he'd wash and take care of his arms, which he refused to do. I called him up and asked whether it was okay if I came to visit him. He was fine with it, and asked if I could bring him some cigarettes and a pastrami sandwich with lots of mustard. So I showed up, and he ate the sandwich, and I tried to get him to wash his arms. Again, our exchange was kind and loving and caring, so different from what everyone around either of us thought our exchange would be like, based on our past turmoil. I still hadn't recognized how unhealthy my own dynamic of relating to him had been before he left the band. I never understood just how sensitive he was and how hurtful I was capable of being. I didn't know that all of the jokes and the jabs and the kidding and the goofing and the sarcasm had really hurt his feelings and had a long-lasting impact on him. Long after John quit, Flea said to me, "Do you have any idea how much pain you caused John?" "What are you talking about? He and I were best friends. We spent every waking moment together. We played pool together. We chased women together. We ate Lucky Charms together. We were two peas in a pod." "No, you hurt John's feelings a lot of the time," Flea said, "because he looked up to you and you were so brutal to him." That was the first time I was even aware that my love for him had ended up being a difficult experience for him. When John left the band, I resented him for not being my friend and for abandoning our musical comradeship. But all the time that he was out of the band and going through this anguish, I prayed for him constantly. From going to meetings, I'd learned that one of the reasons that alcoholics get loaded is because they harbor resentments. One of the techniques they teach to get rid of a resentment towards somebody is to pray for him or her to get everything that you want for yourself in life. To be loved, to be successful, to be healthy, to be rich, to be wonderful, to be happy, to be alive with the light and the love of the universe. It's a paradox, but it works. You sit there and pray for the person you can't stand to get everything on earth that you would want for yourself, and one day you're like, "I don't feel anything bad toward this person." That was part of the reason I prayed for John. The other part was that I didn't want him to die a sad and miserable death, so I prayed for him almost every day. I would sit there and say, "Whoever's out there, whoever's getting this thought from my mind, could you please look after John Frusciante, because he needs it." In January 1998, Bob Forrest convinced John to check into Los Encinos, the same old-school treatment facility that housed W.C. Fields back in the day. John had already kicked heroin by then, but he had been smoking crack and drinking. I went to visit him there, and he seemed committed to being in there, but a little peculiar. Our conversations were sparse and unusual. Every now and then we'd talk about a Nirvana song or a Da Vinci drawing. During one of my visits, we were sitting there having one of these minimalist conversations when John jumped off the bed and went flying into a perfect James Brown split, circa 1968. Then he got up and sat back down. I don't know what his motivation was, but it seemed like he was feeling his oats and letting it be known that he still had the fire to fly into a James Brown split, if need be. I was open to the possibility of John coming back to the band, even if it still seemed remote to me. After leaving Los Encinos at the beginning of February, John rented a small apartment in Silver Lake. One day in April, Flea went over there, and they sat together and listened to records. Then Flea popped the question.
"What would you think about coming back and playing in the band?"
John started sobbing and said, "Nothing would make me happier in the world." They both cried and hugged each other for a long time. Then Flea took a trip to Cambodia, which gave John and me time to clear the air and talk about the problems we had in the past. We went to the farmer's market, one of my favorite places in all of L.A., and sat down and had some salmon tacos. I broke the ice. "Do you have a problem with me at all about anything?"
"No, not really," he said. "What about you? Are you mad at me for anything?"
I thought I was, but I don't feel mad right now. I thought we should probably go over all this stuff, but I don't feel bothered by any of it anymore, I confessed.
"Me neither," John agreed.
Flea was expecting to get a report of some day-long deliberation deal, of all this animosity dredged up, but neither of us was feeling it. The major problem was John didn't even have a guitar to his name. So we went over to the Guitar Center, and I bought him a great old 62 Stratocaster. John was thrilled by the idea of being back in the band, but he was also scared, because he hadn't played a guitar in a very long time. We decided to make his return low-key. Nothing mattered other than playing music. We didn't give a fuck about record deals, or the fact that our manager had quit, or that our record company had lost interest in us. None of that mattered. We just wanted to get in the garage and rock out together. Flea was living in an incredible Mediterranean superstructure in Los Feliz, a famous old house because tons of musicians like Bob Dylan and Lou Reed had lived there. We assembled in Flea's garage, a portion of which he had converted to a rehearsal space. Chad had set up his drums in the corner. Flea had this look on his face like,
"Okay, no great expectations, let's just play music."
We had some shitty little PA system set up. John wore a look of uncertainty, but he plugged in his guitar, and we started playing. And it was us again. I think I might be the only one who thought so, but the room filled up with heavenly music, made for no motive other than to see what it sounded like when we banged our instruments together. For me, that was the defining moment of what would become the next 6 years of our lives together. That was when I knew that this was the real deal, that magic was about to happen again. Suddenly we could all hear, we could all listen, and instead of being caught up in our finite little balls of bullshit, we could all become players in that great universal orchestra again. Chapter 14. Welcome to Californication. Despite my elation at our reunion, it took a while for us to find the groove. John was rusty, both mentally and physically. I was a pile of rust dust too, but slowly and surely, things started getting better. There was a lot of joy emanating from Flea's house. He had two dogs, a mastiff named Martian and a feisty boxer called Laker. Every day we'd make tea in the kitchen, play with the dogs, and then go out to the garage and work. Flea had set up the rehearsal space like a recording studio, so at the end of the session I'd leave with tapes of the new music to lyricize. Although he'll tell you it took years for him to get his chops back, I loved the way John was playing when he didn't have the technical capacity to do everything. He toned down and developed an incredible minimalist style. Every day he'd come up with something spectacular. I had a notebook filled with lyrics that I was dying to turn into songs, so besides the rehearsals, I'd go hang out with John at his apartment in Silver Lake. In typical John fashion, there was no furniture at all, just records and a turntable and a bed and a blender. He was going through a smoothie phase, so there were smoothie materials on the walls and the refrigerator and the stove. It was like Jackson Pollock lived there. We'd sit and smoke, and work. It was incredible to once again have one of the great musicians of our time so telepathically connected to me. He'd play me a complicated, weird, instrumental piece of music that he had stayed up all night recording, and I'd be like, oh yeah, I know exactly what I'm supposed to do with that. John seemed truly humbled by life. He had been beaten down, and I think the clouds had lifted, and he saw what he had been through and felt like, holy fuck, I can't believe I'm alive. I'm not going to blow it this time. He hadn't been back long enough for people to tell him how wonderful he was. It's always nice to be around someone who's that talented and that excited about life and music, and whose ego hasn't been inflated by other people yet. Everyone was having fun. It was as if we had nothing to lose, nothing to gain. We didn't care. We were making music for the sake of making music. Compared to Blood Sugar, One Hot Minute wasn't nearly as successful, so people had lost faith in us. There was a feeling within the record industry that we'd had our day in the sun. But the more we played, the more we started creating stuff that we believed in and wanted people to hear. It was really hot when we began rehearsing, so we would leave the garage door open. After a few weeks of work, I ran into Gwen Stefani of No Doubt. She was Flea's distant neighbor across the ravine on the opposite mountain. I hear you guys play every day, she said. My friends come over and we sit around and listen. It sounds great. It was nice to get the compliment, but it was a bit embarrassing because we thought we were in this private world, working out our ugly spots. At the beginning of June, we took a break from rehearsing to play our first gig since John had rejoined the band. I had promised the Dalai Lama that we would be available if we got the call from Adam Yoke, and we did. The Tibetan Freedom Festival was a 2-day event at JFK Stadium in Washington, D.C. The night before, we did a surprise gig at the 9:30 Club just to get our sea legs. Come the day of the show, the area got drenched with a thunderstorm, and halfway through the concert, a girl got hit by a lightning bolt, forcing the evacuation of the entire stadium and the cancellation of the rest of the show. That night, there was a logistical meeting. The Beastie Boys camp obviously didn't have our back, because the organizers told us that due to the previous day's storm, some groups would have to be canceled. Since we were the last band booked, we wouldn't be able to play. I couldn't believe it. We'd come all the way from California, and were pumped to play our first big show with John back in front of 90,000 people. Thankfully, Pearl Jam was scheduled to close the show that day, and Eddie Vedder got wind of our dilemma and threatened to pull out unless we were given part of their allotted stage time. It was an amazing show of support from them, and we never forgot it. It was still light out when we assembled backstage. We stood behind the backdrop, surrounded by amplifier cases, and got into a soul circle, bowed our heads, and did a collective group hug. Then we went out there and completely rocked out. The audience was 100% behind us, and it was such a joyful moment to be back on stage with John. The next day, I figured everybody had forgotten about the poor girl who'd been hit in the head by lightning, so I went to visit her in the hospital. She was in bed but awake, and she showed me all her burn marks. Her worst burns were where she had metal on her body, a bracelet, her underwire bra. But the really ironic thing was that she was talking on her cell phone when she got hit. That's probably why the lightning hit her. And her last name was Selfin. Back in L.A., the songs were coming fast and furious. Except for one. The first song that John and I worked on, even before we convened in Flea's garage, was a song called Californication. I'd written the lyrics when I was on that cleansing trip to Thailand, when the idea of John being back in the band was still inconceivable to me. While I was on a boat in the Andaman Sea, the melody had crept up on me, one of those simple melody structures that lends itself to flying words into. One of the things that struck me on my travels to exotic places, including the Sea Gypsy Village in Thailand and all the bazaars of Indonesia, was the extent to which American culture had permeated all these places, even to the time of bootleg Red Hot Chili Peppers t-shirts. When I was in Auckland one time, I ran into a crazy lady on the street, and she was ranting about the fact that there were psychic spies in China. That phrase stuck in my mind, so when I was back home, I started writing and writing, and they became my favorite of all the lyrics that I'd collected over the last year. I showed Californication to John, and he loved the lyrics and started writing some music. But for some reason, even though there was a perfect song in there, we couldn't find it. We tried 10 different arrangements and 10 different choruses, and nothing ever worked. All these other songs were pouring out of us. We'd been working for a few weeks when someone started playing an ultra-sparse riff that sounded like nothing we'd ever done before. As soon as I heard it, I knew it was our new song. Around that time, I had met a young mother at a meeting. She was living in a YWCA with her baby girl, trying to get sober but failing miserably. The beauty and sadness and tragedy and glory all wrapped into one of this mother-daughter relationship was evoked by the vibe of that music. From Porcelain. Porcelain, do you carry the moon in your womb? Someone said that you're fading too soon, drifting and floating and fading away. Little loon, all day, little loon. Porcelain, are you wasting away in your skin? Are you missing the love of your kin, nodding and melting and fading away? By late June, we had completed about 12 songs. Scar Tissue was another song where you open up the top of your head and it comes dusting down from outer space. Rick Rubin and I had been talking about sarcasm a lot. Rick had read a theory that it was an incredibly detrimental form of humor that depresses the spirit of its proponents. We had been such sarcastic dicks that we vowed to try to be funny without using sarcasm as a crutch. I guess I was also thinking of Dave Navarro, who was the king of sarcasm, faster and sharper than the average bear. All those ideas were in the air when John started playing this guitar riff, and I immediately knew what the song was about. It was a playful, happy-to-be-alive, phoenix-rising-from-the-ashes vibe. I ran outside with my handheld tape recorder, and with that music playing in the background, started singing the entire chorus to the song. I'll never forget looking up at the sky above that garage, out toward Griffith Park with the birds flying overhead, and getting a dose of Jonathan Livingston's seagull. I really did have the point of view of those birds, feeling like an eternal outsider. From Scar Tissue. Scar tissue that I wish you saw. Sarcastic, Mr. Know-It-All. Close your eyes, and I'll kiss you, because with the birds I'll share this lonely view. With the birds I'll share this lonely view. Push me up against the wall, young Kentucky girl in a push-up bra, falling all over myself to lick your heart and taste your health, because with the birds I'll share this lonely view. Blood loss in a bathroom stall, southern girl with a scarlet drawl. Wave goodbye to Ma and Pa, because with the birds I'll share this lonely view. We finished another song called Emit Remus, which had been inspired in part by my friendship with Melanie Chisholm of the Spice Girls. Around that time, the Spice Girls were a raging phenomenon, especially among young girls like Flea's daughter, Clara. Even when I'd go to New Zealand, all the little girls there would know the Spice Girls lyrics and their dance moves. The tunes were pretty good pop songs, especially when you had 5 different colored crayons out there performing them. That spring, I got a call from Nancy Berry, who ran Virgin Records. She told me that the Spice Girls were coming to L.A., and both the Melanies wanted to go out and have some fun and get some tattoos. Being the resident fun and tattoo meister, I was enlisted to show them the Hollywood ropes. I arranged to have my friend keep his tattoo parlor open after hours to accommodate them. I became friendly with Mel C., Sporty, and we stayed in touch for months and months. It was nice because I got to take Clara to the show and bring her backstage so she could meet these incredible characters she'd been worshipping for the last year. Fast forward to September and Clara's 10th birthday. Flea had been arguing for months and months with Clara when it came to the background music in their house, because Flea wanted to hear Coltrane and Clara had the Spice Girls on a non-stop loop. So Flea decided we were going to pull a stunt at her birthday party. He dropped the hint to Clara that the Spice Girls themselves might show up at her party. And of course, we would be the Spice Girls. The likenesses were obvious. Flea would be Baby Spice. John was Sporty Spice. Chris Warren, our drum technician, was enlisted to play Scary Spice, and I would be Posh Spice. Thank God Ginger Spice was already out of the band and we didn't have to fill her shoes. With the help of Flea's assistant, Sherry Westridge, we got the right clothes and the right wigs and wore the right makeup. We each studied the personality and the body language of our Spice Girl and learned the dance moves. We even had some rehearsals. Come the day of the party, Clara had her whole clan of 10-year-old friends over, all of whom lived and died for the Spice Girls. Everybody was whispering about the possibility that the Spice Girls were coming because Clara had actually met them at their show. So it came time for the surprise, and we were all up in Flea's bedroom putting the final touches on our outfits while the girls were in the living room one floor below. The music started, and the little girls all freaked out, screaming, "Oh my God!" as we walked down the giant staircase and they caught a glimpse of these fabulous costumes. Then something slowly started to filter into their little minds.
"Wait a second, those are not the Spice Girls. In fact, those are not even girls. These are men dressed like the Spice Girls. Ew!"
We sauntered down and never broke character and put on an immaculate performance. Scary Spice was phenomenal. Baby Spice was terrifying with her gap flea tooth. And John absolutely nailed Sporty, working on it morning, noon, and night until his character was there. Posh was easy. She was just an aloof, uptight, narcissistic shopping girl. We took our little vocal solos and did our dances. I had on a really short skirt because Posh wears her dresses too short, but I forgot to take into consideration that I was a man in front of kids. I don't think any of them have ever recovered because we didn't shave our legs. Now that it was clear our foursome was a viable configuration once again, it was time to get management. 2 months earlier, we hadn't cared if we had a manager because nothing was going on, but we were more passionate than ever about the music we were generating. A few years before, Rick Rubin had been extolling the virtues of Q Prime management. Q Prime was run by a duo, Peter Mensch and Cliff Bernstein, and in Rick's mind, they were the brightest managers in the rock business, bar none. These two guys flew in from New York to meet with us in Flea's living room. Cliff looked a lot older than he was, because his hair and his long Merlin the Magician beard were all white. He was small and delicate and purposeful and mystical-looking. He wore glasses and looked super intelligent. He was like a walking think tank, an organic computer man with a competitive nature that belied his appearance. Peter, on the other hand, was a gruff, loud, obnoxious bundle of muscles who alienated and was brash. He was also very smart and, in a bizarre way, very loving. These guys were very New York. They'd been in the music business forever, having managed acts as diverse as Metallica, whom they raised from inception, AC/DC, Madonna, Courtney Love, The Smashing Pumpkins, Def Leppard, and Shania Twain. Cliff and Peter operated at a different level of professionalism than we'd ever dealt with. We were not exactly coming off a year of greatness, but we did feel that with John back in the band, we held a pretty good hand. Flea had a laundry list of concerns, like, "Are you going to get us on the radio?" Peter was countering that by barking, "And don't think we're the kind of managers who are going to take care of you little candy asses. If you're on tour, and you're up in Alaska, and you forgot your winter coat, don't call us to FedEx you a winter coat, because you're going to end up freezing to death." I was like, "Okay. Make a mental note to bring my coat when we tour in Alaska." At the same time, I was sure they were wiping Madonna's ass if she was asking them to. Maybe that was why he said that. But there was some chemistry in the room, and we were attracted to each other, so we signed with them. With all this newness in place, we thought that maybe it was time to get a new producer. Every time you make a record, it doesn't matter how good it was working with a producer, and even if you know you're going to end up making a record with that same person again, there's always a day when someone says, "Do we want to get a new producer?" That was how we felt then about Rick Rubin. We considered our options. We had asked Brian Eno to produce us 3 times already, and he always said no, so we asked him again, even though that no was inevitable. We didn't know it, but he was doing us a favor by turning us down. We even considered David Bowie, who wanted to work with us, but finally sent a gracious note explaining that he had too many other commitments to take on another project. Another reason why we were reluctant to go back with Rick Rubin was that he was always working on 6 things at once, plus being CEO of his own record label, and we thought we should find someone who would work only on our project. While this process was going on, we contacted Daniel Lenoir, who had converted an old movie theater in Oxnard, California, just up the coast, into a wonderful old-school recording studio. Lenoir couldn't commit to producing us because he was on hold with U2, but he did graciously offer us the use of his studio to do a demo of the 11 songs we had finished. We went in and set up and recorded all of the songs in a row, all in one day. It was a soulful, smoking demo, not unlike the first demo we ever made. A couple of weeks went by, and we talked to Rick. He cleared some space in his schedule, so we decided to work with him again. It was as if we had come to our senses and realized, why are we dicking around with all these other guys? The next day, I got a call from Daniel Lenoir.
I heard the demo you made at the studio, he said. I've reconsidered, and I'm interested in working with you guys. Those songs really caught my attention. I haven't heard anything like them in a long time.
I genuinely appreciated his kind words, though I told him we'd moved on. However, it was nice to have